Mark, a 25-year-old gay man, is a new patient at your clinic. After a routine physical, he asks you about an ad he heard on the radio regarding prevention therapy for HIV. Specifically, he's curious about how it works and whether he should consider taking it. He's currently in a long-term relationship with a single male partner and does not use intravenous drugs. Both Mark and his partner were HIV negative last month. How will you explain PrEP to Mark? Hey, and welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Alex Dennis, and this is the brick on the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. Let's jump right in. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Define HIV infection and AIDS and discuss the epidemiology. 2. Describe the replication and life cycle of a retrovirus and describe how HIV infection leads to immune deficiency. 3. Describe the presentation of a patient with HIV infection, with and without AIDS, and list common opportunistic infections seen in patients with AIDS. 4. Describe the diagnosis of HIV and AIDS. And 5. Outline therapeutic and preventive approaches to HIV/AIDS. Part 1. What are HIV and AIDS? In 1959, the first case of immunodeficiency virus to infect a human was documented in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo. Scientists would go on to theorize that the man contracted what became known as HIV-1 from a West African chimpanzee infected with simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, probably from coming into contact with the chimp's blood while hunting and killing it for meat. Over the next couple of decades, the virus spread through Africa and to other parts of the world, including the United States by the late 1970s. That's when Kaposi sarcoma and pneumocystis jiovecii pneumonia, rare illnesses that do not normally occur in people with healthy immune systems, began occurring in men who had sex with men, abbreviated MSM, and intravenous IV drug users. In 1982, public health officials adopted the term acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, or AIDS, to describe these opportunistic infections. A year later, the virus that causes AIDS was discovered and named human T-cell lymphotropic virus type 3, lymphadenopathy-associated virus, HDLV3-LAV. This unwieldy tongue twister was later changed to human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. HIV is a retrovirus, which means that it converts its RNA into DNA for integration into a host genome. HIV interrupts the body's immune system, it is spread through the blood and blood products, as well as through sexual contact, and can cause AIDS. By 1990, an estimated 8 to 10 million people worldwide were infected with HIV. Initially untreatable, patients succumbed to opportunistic infections, such as P. jiovecii pneumonia or toxoplasmosis. Such infections are caused by a pathogen that takes advantage of an opportunity not normally available, such as a host with a weakened immune system, as in a patient with HIV. Treatment evolved into highly active antiretroviral therapy, abbreviated HART, which is still the treatment protocol today. Now, more than half of the 36.7 million people infected with HIV globally are receiving treatment. And believe it or not, people with HIV on HART have a lifespan about 2 years older than the rest of the population, just because of their medical checkups. Go science! That being said, there are still about 1.1 million people in the United States infected with the virus, and the incidence has increased in MSM and the African American and Hispanic populations. Part 2. How does a retrovirus survive and replicate? To fully understand retroviruses, we must distinguish them from other types of RNA viruses. Although a retrovirus is composed of ribonucleic acid, RNA, it has an enzyme known as reverse transcriptase that makes it unique. The reverse transcriptase allows the retrovirus to create DNA from its RNA, integrating with host cells' DNA and making replication possible. This is in contrast to an RNA virus, which lacks reverse transcriptase and cannot synthesize DNA. Let's walk through HIV's life cycle. But first, a bit of context. HIV's genome consists of two RNA strands. These are encapsulated in a capsid, which itself is surrounded by a matrix, which ensures the integrity of the virion. And then finally, there's the viral envelope, which surrounds the whole thing, and that's composed of a lipid bilayer, the same one that surrounds human cells. And that's no coincidence, because that's exactly where that lipid bilayer comes from. On that note, let's look at the life cycle. First step, the HIV virion binds to and fuses with the host cell. It does that thanks to the little spikes all over its envelope. Each of these spikes are made of the glycoproteins GP120 and GP41. GP120 binds to the cellular receptors, which induces a conformational change in GP120 that exposes GP41, which in turn mediates fusion. So now, the viral capsid is free-floating in the cell. At this point, HIV releases numerous viral proteins, including the enzymes reverse transcriptase and integrase. Reverse transcriptase starts its job, converting viral RNA to DNA. That DNA is brought to the nucleus, where the enzyme integrase integrates it into the host DNA. So now that the viral DNA is integrated within the host DNA, it's transcribed by the host DNA, which unfortunately doesn't know any better. What happens then? Well, all that brand new HIV RNA exits the nucleus and has two fates. Part of it is translated into immature HIV proteins. The other part is going to make up the two genomic strands of the new virions. The virus assembles at the plasma membrane and matures after budding from the cell. It does that by releasing a protease which cleaves the immature proteins to yield mature HIV virions. From there, the cycle goes on. These new virions are able to go on and infect other cells. Let's take a quick break here to review a few things we just went over. What two glycoproteins make up HIV's envelope spike? These would be GP120 and GP41, which are actually encoded by the same gene, the ENV gene. That gene encodes for GP160, which is subsequently cleaved in the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, let's try another one. What enzyme allows the newly synthesized viral DNA to be integrated into the host DNA? The enzyme integrase carries out this function. And here's our last one. What are the two important fates of the viral RNA once it's transcribed by the host? Part of that RNA is translated to make the immature HIV proteins, the other will serve as the new virion's genome. Okay, so this is an overview of what happens at the level of one cell. But let's now zoom out and consider the whole. In a patient infected with HIV, the progression to immunodeficiency is not immediate. What's the link between the life cycle we just went over and the weakening of the immune system? To understand this, it's important to appreciate that the HIV virions target CD4-positive cells specifically, which include CD4 T lymphocytes and macrophages. These CD4-positive T cells are central mediators of immune response in humans, crucially coordinating cellular and humoral immune responses against infections. No CD4 cells, no immune system. What makes HIV specific to these cells is actually GP120. It binds to CD4 and chemokine co-receptors CXCR4 or CCR5, which again, allows fusion to be mediated by GP41. Accordingly, the main reservoir cells for HIV may be monocytes, microglial cells, dendritic cells, macrophages, and B lymphocytes. There are actually a few ways HIV leads to cell death and ultimate decline of CD4 cells. Directly, HIV hijacks cells to make copies of itself, which can overwhelm the cell and cause it to burst. Or, HIV can exhaust the cell's resources, which can trigger apoptosis. It's even hypothesized, and I think this is a super cool fact, that the biggest CD4 decline may actually be from non-infected bystander cells dying as a response to pro-apoptotic signals coming from infected cells. Regardless of the etiology of cell death, the fact is that as a patient's CD4 count declines, the immune system weakens, which increases the risk for opportunistic infections. Let's pause here for a quick recall. Which type of cell does HIV primarily infect? HIV primarily infects CD4 lymphocytes. These T cells are used by the virus to replicate. Part 3. How does HIV present clinically? When a patient is first infected with HIV, often there are no signs or symptoms. In some patients, an acute illness may occur 2 to 4 weeks, even up to months after infection, with symptoms similar to those of mononucleosis. So you'll see fever, sore throat, rash, lymphadenopathy, gastrointestinal upset, and myalgia. After the acute illness, if it was ever present, the most likely scenario is for a patient to go years without becoming severely immunosuppressed, which is generally considered to be a CD4 cell count of less than 200 cells per cubic millimeter. The AIDS-related complex, ARC, can manifest in this period when the CD4 count is between 200 and 499. It includes generalized lymphadenopathy, even in the absence of other symptoms, and fever or weight loss. Although this ARC is not full AIDS, it marks a presentation of HIV in a patient with possibly decreasing CD4 levels. Severe immunosuppression due to HIV eventually leads to the development of AIDS within 2 to 20 years. Again, this involves opportunistic infections due to a low CD4 cell count. And let me tell you, there are a lot of opportunistic infections that mostly show up just in the context of AIDS. So what I'd like to do now is go over some of those opportunistic infections. Instead of breaking it down by organ system affected, I'm instead going to break it down by CD4 count at which you have to start worrying about these complications. The reason I'm doing it this way is because it's an important parameter clinically, because that's what's going to dictate which prophylactic agent you add to your patient's regimen. Before diving into these, let's do a quick recap. What are the three stages of HIV infection? There's an acute phase, which can present with mononucleosis-like illness anywhere from 2 weeks up to even a few months. Then there's typically a chronic, asymptomatic phase. And finally, the last stage is AIDS. Recall that the AIDS-related complex, or ARC, can manifest towards the tail end of the chronic period before AIDS, as generalized lymphadenopathy, fever, and/or weight loss. Okay, so getting back to the review of the opportunistic infections. At a CD4 count less than 500, I remember that I have to worry about superficial stuff, meaning stuff I can see. That includes oropharyngeal candidiasis, which is characterized by white removable plaques. It may be one of the first telltale sign infections that the CD4 count is dipping. Then, there's also oral hairy leukoplakia, caused by reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, which is herpes 4. That presents as white patches on the lateral sides of the tongue, but it can't be scraped off. In line with that visible criterion, Kaposi sarcoma, caused by human herpes virus 8, is a vascular tumor and presents with multiple brown or purple blotchy lesions that may grow in organ systems, mucous membranes, and on the skin. And then finally, and this one's a bit of a stretch, but below a CD4 count of 500, squamous cell carcinoma, commonly in the anus in MSM, caused by HPV can also be seen. I should mention that these constitutional symptoms such as fever, lymphadenopathy, and weight loss continue. Alrighty, moving on to a CD4 count of less than 200. We're starting to get into the more severe territory. At this stage, HIV itself can lead to dementia. This is referred to as HIV encephalopathy, or AIDS-related dementia, and may manifest as memory loss or concentration problems. Recurrent pneumonia due to P. geovetci can also occur. And then when you start dipping below a CD4 count of 100, it's almost a free-for-all. At this point, there's a bunch of bugs we need to worry about. Viruses, bacteria, fungi, and parasites alike. Starting with viruses, cytomegalovirus, or herpes 5, includes manifestations like esophagitis and retinitis. Since we just mentioned herpes 5, let's talk about herpes 4, or Epstein-Barr virus, which can cause CNS lymphoma, the same way toxoplasma, a nasty parasite, can cause brain abscesses. The difference is EBV lymphoma will present as a solitary, ring-enhancing lesion, whereas toxoplasma presents with multiple ring-enhancing lesions on MRI. Staying in the brain, the last bug we have to worry about here is Cryptococcus neoformans, which is a nasty fungus that can cause a meningitis and can be diagnosed with India ink stain. Alright, we already covered a lot, so let's see how much of this stuck. How are EBV and toxoplasma brain lesions differentiated on MRI? EBV lymphoma usually presents as a single ring-enhancing lesion, while toxoplasma abscesses reveal multiple ring-enhancing lesions on MRI. Alright, let's move a bit down to the pulmonary system. I should mention, these are not restricted to a count below 100, but they're pretty bad, so they fit here well. People infected with HIV are more susceptible to tuberculosis. Also, untreated latent TB infection is more likely to advance to TB disease in people with HIV than in people without HIV. Another pulmonary bug to discuss is coccidiomycosis, which may be pulmonary or extrapulmonary and is characterized by non-productive cough and possible skin lesions. The last organ system complications to go over are the ones that affect the GI tract. The most common cause of AIDS diarrhea is hands down Cryptosporidium parvum. It's the organism most commonly identified in HIV-positive patients with diarrhea. That being said, AIDS diarrhea can also be caused by another parasite called Cystoisospora belli. Let's again pause here. What is the most common cause of AIDS diarrhea? That would be Cryptosporidium parvum. The last bug we have to discuss is Mycobacterium avium complex, or MAC. It's a good thing we're tackling it last, because it only becomes a problem at severely reduced CD4 cell count, think below 50. At that point, you're dealing with disseminated MAC infection that presents with non-specific systemic symptoms like fever, night sweats, and weight loss, and most commonly GI upset and diarrhea. Part 4. How are HIV and AIDS diagnosed? To recap, HIV causes cellular immune deficiency by way of the depletion of CD4 cells, which then leads to opportunistic infections and cancers. So then, the diagnosis is based on screening for HIV, the presence of a CD4 count less than 200, and infections and cancers. There are several methods used to screen potentially infected patients. Enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, ELISA, detects viral antigens and antibodies to HIV. This is useful as a preliminary test and as a screening test for anyone. ELISA is performed in a lab and is highly sensitive so as to not miss any infections. The idea is that a negative, highly sensitive test allows us to rule out a disease. You use a sensitive test if you want to make sure you don't miss whatever you're looking for if it's there. Also, polymerase chain reaction or PCR testing can detect HIV infection before antibodies form, earlier than any other method. However, because of the associated high costs and difficulty of running a PCR test, it is not often performed. All right, here's a broad question. What quality is desirable in a screening test in terms of test accuracy? A highly sensitive test, such as an ELISA, to detect antigens or antibodies to HIV, is desirable as a screening test to ensure a positive infection is not missed or overlooked. Confirmatory testing also must be done in case of a positive screening result. This is not done using an HIV-1/HIV-2 differentiation immunoassay, which basically works the same way as an ELISA. This test now has a high specificity so as not to produce false positive results. The differentiation assay is now the standard. However, Western blot was used for many years. Rapid screening antibody tests exist as well, which can be performed at home. These generally use oral fluid or blood and also provide preliminary screening, which, like the ELISA screening test, would need to be confirmed. Let's see if that stuck with you. Which laboratory test is often used to screen for HIV? An ELISA, which can detect both viral antigens and antibodies, is often used to screen for HIV, but a confirmatory test is required. Okay, so once infection has been confirmed, the next step may be measurement of CD4 count to determine the level of immune suppression. Again, a count lower than 200 generally indicates progression to AIDS, but the presence of opportunistic illnesses like candidiasis and P. geovecii may also validate the diagnosis without such a low count. That's why these opportunistic illnesses are also referred to as AIDS-defining illnesses. In addition, viral load can be useful in determining disease presence and immune function. Viral load refers to the number of viral particles in a given volume and can be used to measure how transmissible the infection is to others. A low viral load means a lower probability of transmission. Before moving on, what are the diagnostic criteria for an AIDS diagnosis? Either a CD4 count lower than 200 or a greater count with the presence of AIDS-defining illnesses. Part 5. How is HIV infection treated? Antiretroviral drugs are used to treat HIV infection. The standard treatment today consists of a multi-drug regimen. Types of drugs are based on the steps of the life cycle of HIV. Two different nucleotide-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, NRTIs, and an integrase inhibitor or protease inhibitor have been found to be most effective. Because of drug resistance, special testing and monitoring of CD4 count and viral load may be required by a specialist to make sure the most effective treatment is used. In addition to using antiretrovirals for therapy, pre-exposure and post-exposure prophylaxis exist. For pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, Sexual and drug use history may indicate need in certain individuals. This includes IV drug users, MSM, transgender women with high-risk sexual behavior, and heterosexual people with higher-risk partners. In addition to describing behavioral changes, such as condom use, drugs such as tenofovir and emtricitabine, which are both reverse transcriptase inhibitors, can be prescribed. For post-exposure prophylaxis, PEP, testing is done in addition to giving medications. Antiretrovirals may be started immediately within 72 hours or up to a week for higher-risk individuals with an artery or vein exposed. Treatment may continue for 4 weeks unless the patient tests negative for the infection. Drugs include the same as for PrEP, plus dolutegravir and raltegravir, which are integrase inhibitors. These PEP agents are selected based on what is best tolerated and has the highest potency in people with HIV infection. That's it for the HIV break. Let's review to see what stuck. What is the difference between HIV and AIDS? Though these terms are often used interchangeably, HIV stands for Human Immunodeficiency Virus, while AIDS, or Advanced Immunodeficiency Syndrome, is the condition that may ensue usually years after HIV infection as a result of depletion of CD4 immune cells. How is HIV spread, and what are the at-risk populations? HIV is spread through blood products and sexual contact. At-risk populations include men who have sex with men and IV drug users. What enzyme uniquely separates a retrovirus like HIV from an RNA virus? Like the name indicates, that would be reverse transcriptase, which synthesizes DNA from the viral RNA genome. What on HIV's viral envelope allows it to bind and fuse with host cells? HIV's envelope spikes mediate binding to and fusing with host cells. GP120 on HIV binds to CD4 lymphocyte receptors and co-receptors CXCR5 or CCR4, initiating a conformational change within GP120 that exposes GP41 and allows it to mediate viral fusion. The sequence of events allows viral entry into the cell. How does infection with HIV lead to decreased immunity and ultimately AIDS? HIV targets, infects, and ultimately kills CD4 cells. Among these are CD4 T cells, a pivotal player of immunity. As the CD4 cell count decreases, the degree of immunodeficiency increases. What is the usual time course of HIV infection? Initial HIV infection can cause fever, lymphadenopathy, and other mononucleosis-like symptoms. Even otherwise asymptomatic HIV infection can produce generalized lymphadenopathy. Then, the virus usually lays dormant for a few years. Progression from chronic HIV to AIDS can be characterized by not only constitutional symptoms of fever and weight loss, but also opportunistic infections, such as AIDS-defining illnesses like candidiasis, P. geovetii, and toxoplasmosis. What diagnostic tests are performed to establish an HIV infection diagnosis? Initial tests for HIV include antigen and antibody assays such as an ELISA. PCR provides the earliest detection, but it's costly. The standard confirmatory test is an immunoassay to differentiate HIV-1 and HIV-2. Western blots were previously used for this purpose. CD4 count and viral load can be useful in determining the degree of immunosuppression and transmissibility, respectively. What three medications does modern antiretroviral therapy consist of? Antiretroviral therapy, or ART, typically consists of a three-drug regimen, two of which are different nucleotide nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the other being an integrase inhibitor. ART is indicated for all those infected with HIV. Great job sticking with me. And now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's revisit our patient case from earlier. Mark is curious about how PrEP works and whether he should consider taking it. How will you explain PrEP? You explained that it's actually very similar to the drugs that are used to treat active HIV infection. HIV uses a unique protein called reverse transcriptase in the process to replicate itself. This is how you get millions of copies of the virus, and it is those millions of copies that circulate and do harm. One way to stop HIV is to use a drug that blocks the work of reverse transcriptase, a drug called a reverse transcriptase inhibitor. If reverse transcriptase cannot work, the HIV virus doesn't multiply. For many years, these drugs have been part of treating active infections. More recently, they figured out how to give similar drugs as a preventative treatment. That's pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. Mark appears in awe at the advancements in HIV therapy and asks if he should get on PrEP. You and Mark discuss what needs to be done before he starts PrEP and the everyday and long-term details about taking it. And that's a wrap. Make sure to like and subscribe to this podcast. You can also get the full Rx Bricks experience online at www.usmle-rx.com. I'll catch you on the next one.